Okay, I'm going to tell you about a new study we've started. It's a systematic search for supernova in low redshift galaxy clusters. Here are my collaborators, if you could read them down there. So this is sort of a new game to me, so if you have any comments, constructive criticism, more than welcome. Okay. This fancy slide is simply to remind you that the Mel enrichment of the intercluster medium, the supernova rate in galaxy clusters, and the amount of stellar mass in intracluster light are all intimately related subjects. So type 1a supernovae are found in both old evolved stellar systems and in regions of high star formation. And in fact, type 1a's associated with high star-forming regions tend to be more luminous, and in old evolved stellar populations are a little less luminous. This suggests that there are perhaps two populations of progenitors. I'm not really going to speculate on what the progenitors are, but it would be nice if there was some way to separate out these two populations and study them separately. And perhaps in galaxy clusters, which have a simple star formation history because they're dominated by elliptical galaxies today. And the stars in the elliptical galaxies were thought to form at high redshift during a single burst of star formation, and they've evolved passively since then. Galaxy clusters are large, have deep cluster potentials, and so material doesn't really escape from them. So they're a good closed box system to study. The intercluster medium in galaxy clusters is chemically enriched. So for instance, here's just a compilation of, I think, XMM and Chandra data. On the x-axis is temperature of galaxy clusters, which correlates with the mass of galaxy clusters. And on the y-axis is sort of the iron enrichment in these systems. As you can see, for a large range of cluster temperatures and thus masses, the iron abundance is roughly constant. Now, how did this iron get in the intercluster medium? Is it from outflows from galaxies, mass loss in galaxies? Or are there intracluster supernova going off and polluting the intercluster medium in situ? So a related question is, how much light is there in the intracluster light is there in galaxy clusters? Recent studies have suggested that up to 10 to 20% of the total stellar budget in galaxy clusters are in these intracluster stars. These are basically stars that have been stripped in fast galaxy encounters and now are just in the cluster potential, not bound to an individual galaxy. And can these intracluster supernovae be enriching the intercluster medium in situ? If you understand how much they're polluting the intercluster medium, you could set some constraints on galaxy mass loss in galaxy clusters. Metal mass loss in galaxy clusters, sorry. Another interesting thing you could do is by measuring the ratio of hostless to hosted type 1As, this gives you a crude measurement of the mean intercluster light fraction in your sample of galaxy clusters.
By inverting?
Well, if, let's say, you find 20% of your type 1As are intercluster events, that gives you roughly, that suggests that roughly all the old stars, if you're sampling just this old stellar population, are associated with stars that aren't in galaxies. Yeah, it's just the ratio. Yeah.
You say that 20% of the supernovae from cluster galaxies are
this is
cluster, so they do not belong to a particular cluster.
No, that's not quite what I said. I said roughly 20% of all the stellar light, all the stars in a galaxy cluster, are not associated with an individual galaxy. And so, if these are similar stellar populations, you would expect 20% of the supernovae to come from them. Does that make sense? And indeed, these intercluster supernovae have been observed before. There have been a couple. Right. This is. This is what I'm doing.
Wasn't that also planetary nebula studies done?
I have this vague memory of planetary nebula intercluster.
clustering? There are certainly many. I mean, there are intercluster populations.
Right. So is it the case that this your bullet point two here is actually? It's more than it suggested. I thought it was really clear. I mean, I'm trying to be sure.
Sure. Yeah, it is definitely the case. Yeah. Sorry, not to be too conservative. Yeah. There is lots of intercluster light in galaxy clusters.
Yeah.
20-ish%.
Do we know anything about the population of stars that make up?
Well, just that they shouldn't be too different from those in the galaxies themselves.
Is there a reason why that should be?
Well, why? Because they presumably come from the galaxies themselves, so why would they be different? Do you think the encounters between galaxies would?
Well, it could be that they're stripped from a small, low-mass galaxy with a different population of stars.
So preferentially, So anything I would say today would be modulo those sort of worries. Hopefully this comes out all right. This is just another indication that intercluster supernovae may contribute a large fraction of the metal seen in the intercluster medium. This is a paper by a grad student who's on this team as well. They have data, XMM data of these galaxy clusters where they measured the iron mass. These clusters also have good measurements of the amount of intercluster starlight. And using sort of a standard prescription for supernova rates, they estimated, roughly a relatively large fraction of the total metal enrichment of the intercluster medium would come from these intercluster stars. And using that same supernova rate prescription, this is the amount of metals that they would predict for the total. Go ahead.
So this is because the XCM is less rich than the average cluster galaxy, so most of the metals in the cluster galaxy stay in the cluster galaxies. And the enrichment of the XCM is done by...
Well, this particular study is just trying to piece together what fraction of the metals in the intercluster medium come from outflows from galaxies, say, as opposed to just being spit out there by intercluster stars.
So the answer is most of the metals in the vast majority of supernovae that are in 1A's stay in galaxies, don't go out.
Right. This would set some limit on that. Yeah, that's right. So motivated by all these things, we've begun a supernova search in galaxy clusters. Basically, what we're doing is we're looking at 60 X-ray selected galaxy clusters at low redshift. During our observing season, which runs from late fall to late spring, we revisit these fields roughly every month. With the Stewart Observatory 90-inch on Kitt Peak. And we've had a lot of bad luck so far with spectroscopy, but in the ideal situation, we get follow-up spectroscopy.
So your cadence is once a month?
Roughly, that's right. Whenever we get scheduled by the TAC.
How big is the field of view?
Oh, yeah, I will certainly get to that. Okay, yes, I will get to that. The imager is a 1-degree field imager, but it's slightly more complicated than that. And ideally, what we want is to get spectroscopy of some large fraction of our supernova events, supernova candidates. And the goal would be to find, maybe 1 to 2 dozen confirmed supernova 1As in these galaxy clusters, and try to find some ways to probabilistically determine some of our other transient candidates that we couldn't get spectroscopy for, determine whether or not these could be supernova in the clusters as well. Sorry, you have a question?
Yeah, so I assume you take a spectrum of every transient in your field because you don't have the cadence to say from the light curve if it's a 1A.
Yeah, that's right. So, like I said, we're only going to be able to get spectroscopy for some fraction of our transient candidates.
Right.
And then we will try to use other means to figure out if, like, these things are background events by getting follow-up spectroscopy of the hosts later on.
I'm more interested in the foreground events, but that's...
Right, yeah, that's exactly the worry, because most of the events are foreground.
So what's the visibility time on the 1A at your depth? How long do you...
Right, exactly. So it's roughly 2 weeks before and after. The cadence is about right. But you can model that afterwards, depending on when we get time. So
we should ask Lars.
I'm sure. Yeah.
This exercise. He has a program that can give you the efficiency.
Yeah. Wait, I like the answer.
Yeah. Great.
Well, I understand. So, but why can't?
Why can't I go up there like 5 or 6 nights?
Well, no. So I guess all I'm asking is, you know how much time they're going to give you, presumably.
Roughly.
So then the question is, what's the proper cadence given the time you have?
Right. That's right.
Yeah. So that's the exercise I would do.
Okay. Okay. We can talk about this.
10 nights. What's the best way to cadence your 10 nights?
Sure.
That's the
point.
I mean, you might be fine.
This doesn't seem far off to me. I'm just to find a supernova.
Just to find events. That's right. I may be very wrong.
You see it once. Let me understand. Your criteria is you detect it once.
Right. So, and that's right.
Every transient, you said Canada, basically.
Right. Let me go on. Maybe I can answer some of your questions as I. Yeah. I understand it seems a little spooky right now. Okay. So. So we have several goals: determine the mean fraction of inner cluster starlight by measuring hostless to hosted supernova candidates, determine the rate, supernova 1A rate, as best we can to constrain this type 1A delay time, and presumably we could be probing in a clean way this older progenitor population by looking in galaxy clusters. And at some point, maybe with much more data, we would like to combine these measurements to determine the contribution of intercluster supernovae to the global chemical enrichment of clusters, especially the intercluster medium. So the imager that we're using is 90 prime on the 2.3 meter Bach telescope. Overall, it has a 1 degree field of view. Each chip is 30 arc minutes by 30 arc minutes, and there's a chip gap of 500 arc seconds in between each one. So in practice, what we do is we center each cluster on chip one, which is cosmetically the best chip. And with this field of view, we still go out to R200 in these galaxy clusters. I don't know if you're familiar with that. That's roughly 200 times the critical density of the universe. So very close to the virial radius of these galaxy clusters. And sometimes we go much further than that, depending on the cluster. Sort of for data storage purposes, at the moment, I'm only using chip 3 as sort of a background control. I have all the data, but to process it and everything, I mean, I need to buy another 5 terabyte disk or something. I have a lot of data.
What do you mean by control?
Well, if you can measure the relative rates of transients in these two chips, that may give you some handle on the number that are associated with the clusters versus those that are not, in a statistical sense. Typical seeing is 2 arc seconds. Actually, it's worse than that. I'll show you in a second. Okay, so here's what we've done so far, and actually it's not a lot. We got 11 nights initially, where I basically wrote an image pipeline, a different image differencing pipeline, and in order to demonstrate that we can ID these transients on 1 day time scales or so. And then last winter, we got a bunch of 90-inch nights and spectroscopic nights to perform sort of our full survey. But unfortunately, 11 out of 12 of those 90-inch nights were ruined due to weather. And actually, the imager was basically out of commission the whole time. So the very last night, we got good data finally. And following that, we got one night of blue MMT spectroscopy. So I don't have a lot of results, but I'll show you what we have so far. Okay.
So the single channels that every night you just hit all your clusters?
Yeah, as many clusters as we can. That's in one channel. And actually, lately, we've been doing 2 filters, hopefully to make some color cuts on what we spectroscopically follow up. Of course, we only have one night to sort of try this out with so far.
So how many would you expect?
So, yeah, I'll get to that. If we had a full... We expect 6 to 7 type 1A supernova for like a 4-night 90-inch run that we would find.
Overall.
overall, surveying roughly 50 clusters.
Doing 50 square degrees of mice, okay.
Roughly, but actually we're just looking at this, well, to reduce quickly, I'm just looking at this single chip, 30 arcminutes by 30 arcminutes. I'm not going to follow up transients in one of the other chips that are much further out.
But you should, I guess. If you really want to get the fraction of how many are interclustering,
sure.
Supernovae with respect to your control field, you should know what the fraction of supernovae 1As in your control field is.
Sure, that would be... I guess the assumption is that this is so far out that there's basically no cluster left out there.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not a great assumption, I realize, but given our limited spectroscopic time, this is we would rather get more type 1A spectra in the clusters. Okay, so anyways, I wrote a pipeline to reduce the data, difference the images, and to send it to a website so other people in the group can check them out. I think it's pretty standard. We get 10 candidates. Some of them are just chip defects or whatever, or something close to a bright saturated star. So we need a human to look at it, and some fraction of them appear to be real transients. And then we batch submit even those to NED or various variable star catalogs to make sure to automatically screen out QSOs and stuff like that and variable stars.
Okay, that's the photography.
This came out really bad. Sorry, say that again.
When you submit them to NED and SIMBAT and GCC.
Sure,
that's the position.
That's just the position. If there's something, within a couple arc seconds or whatever, it'll send it back. And this helps us if we know it's within a galaxy cluster by looking it up, and that's something we preferentially follow up. So you can't see this. This really sucks. Sorry. I've also calculated our transient detection efficiency. Maybe I'll walk you through this. So here's G of 18. Here's G of 22 or so. And basically the histogram goes across at 80%. So by putting in fake point sources, basically we model our transient detection efficiency as a function of seeing, air mass, and background. So we only find about 80% of the transients I throw in. This is basically because we mask aggressively near saturated stars. And it's slightly harder to find transients in galaxy cores.
Especially with the
seeing even worse than 2 arc seconds. Right. If you do that, it is closer to 90%, which I think is pretty good.
What's your exposure time and readout time?
4 by 400 seconds, and the readout is 2 minutes. Yeah. So I don't think anyone had done this at the 90 inch for a few years, but
now we know why.
Right. So here's the typical full width half max I found, and it's not great. I understand this. If it's greater than 3 arc seconds seeing and it stays there, I just go to bed.
How many knots is this based on?
This is based on we have some other. This is actually based on 16 nights or so.
16. In winter.
Spring. Some in the winter. Sure. The 90 inches on the worst spot in the mountain at Kitt Peak. It's on the saddle, and there's like howling winds that go by it. Yeah. While like Lars was saying earlier, the wind telescope could get half arc second seeing. The pixels on this are half arc second because they know the seeing is not good.
So this is probably also optics in the telescope.
Yes. Yeah. So we have plenty of inner cluster candidates. Unfortunately, we didn't get any of that one good night we had where we had spectroscopic follow-up. We found 5 hostless events, all within, during our initial photometric campaign, all within a megaparsec of the cluster center. Basically, we get 1 intercluster event per 4-night imaging run. And I sort of have a routine that automatically sums all our available other available imaging epochs to rule out a faint host. And that gets better as we get more epochs for each cluster field.
So what you do is that you check for each transient if there is also a source. You basically say that you don't want any source in any of the other images at that machine.
That's right. And actually, my routine automatically does that. If it showed up as a variable in past epochs, uh-huh. I mean, it automatically gets flagged and thrown out.
Even as a detection in past epochs.
Well, I mean, I'm looking for all supernovae, but for these in particular, if a human observer says, if the human checker says, oh, it doesn't look like there's a host there, he'll flag it, and then I will go off and start the routine that will sum all the available images except for this epoch.
Right, so that by that way you throw out any variable stars that have a quiescent magnitude above your single epoch. Detection limit. Because there's already something there, and it just became brighter.
Sure. Yes, that's right. Okay, so, but I think I've detected a central excess of transited events with these, in the cores of these galaxy clusters. So if I take the X-ray luminosity of each cluster, there is a scaling relation, if you choose to believe it, between the luminosity of a cluster and its mass at R of 200, at 200 times the critical density. And so I scaled each cluster to this radius and plotted basically the number of transit events as a function per unit area as a function of radius in these clusters. And I also used this CHIP3 control field to get a what I guess you would call a background rate. And this is the one sigma sort of error bar on that at the moment. And that will get better because I'm not quite done calculating the detection efficiency for all our CHIP3 fields. Okay, so I think I believe that more or less. A lot of these things are not just supernova though. They can be due to cluster AGN, and this has been seen in X-ray studies performed with Chandra. So here are
background objects being lensed.
Right. So we look for these. I actually preferentially select galaxy clusters that have known strong lensing features. In my former life, I'm sort of a strong lensing guy, dark matter guy. So I pretty much know all the galaxy clusters that have strong lensing features. And I look at them, and we've had one or two sort of close, nothing, no.
I'm not saying strong lensing, but just a bias, a slight enhancement of can cause you to bring them into your detection.
I see, yeah, that may be.
What's the luminosity function of the loop? I mean, what's the number count slope? Let me vision bias can work identity as well. What's the number count slope for the number
It should be go with the volume.
Yeah, that's interesting. So here are the type 1As that we definitely found with our one night of spectroscopy, overplotted with Nugent templates. Only two out of these four are actually in the clusters. But this jives about right with what I expected. In a four-ish night run, I said we expected six, and one night we got two. You know, that's more or less what we expected.
What do you mean? Only two of them are in the cluster?
Yeah, these are background events.
They are in the control field, or they?
No, they are in the cluster fields, but they're background.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's the redshifts.
Yes, we know the redshifts of the clusters. We got plenty of other spectra, lots of QSOs at redshift 2, and.
So these were not known by NED?
Right, so a lot of them, unless Sloan has covered the field, you can have a hard time. But a lot of them we could throw out if Sloan's looked at the field. We found one other core collapse supernovae, but we also have several other spectra of cluster galaxies that don't have any obvious emission lines. I just need to figure out a smart way to subtract out the galaxy light to see if there's a supernova underneath.
And the number of variable stars?
Like three or something. You know, I'm not an expert in these things, so I said, well, it's at Z of zero, so it's the star. yeah, sometimes, sure.
Mind if we have a look?
You're missing the big picture.
No, I'm not missing the big picture. I'm trying to get
small bit the big.
Yeah, I would certainly be happy to send you all my spectra. So I recognize that it's just little old me trying to do this survey. I'm never going to be one of these big guys who gets tons of spectroscopy time. And so hopefully we can find other ways of sort of probabilistically determining whether each event may or may not be associated with the cluster. One way is we're getting multi-band imaging of all these clusters, and you know, if a transient goes off in a galaxy that's on the cluster red sequence, the event is probably a type 1A associated with this galaxy in the cluster, because you know, core collapse supernova tend to go off in star-forming galaxies, and ellipticals are not star-forming galaxies. This is not foolproof, but this is sort of like a probabilistic way of looking at it. And there's loads of 90-inch spectrograph time available, and we are going to take spectrum of a lot of our hosts to determine at what rate they are foreground or background events, or if they're obviously QSOs. And after a lot of work, we think we could get a pretty good idea of what events were located in the cluster and what weren't. Okay? That's sort of the goal, ultimately.
So the rule is, if something is not in a host, you try to follow it up immediately.
Yeah, that's the plan. And we have been I know this is not really my style, but I've even called people at the MMT to get a spectrum.
If something is in the host, you say, well, maybe I can figure out after.
Figure it out later, that's right. If we can't get a spectrum, because we can't. So the idea is to get a spectrum of as much as we can, and to try to determine through other means everything else. So there are other things you could do with this survey. For instance, I wouldn't mind studying cluster AGN, and the central excess of transients is pretty interesting to me. And also, if you difference each individual exposure, we're pretty sensitive to sort of 1,000-second timescale fast transients. And presumably most of these would be M-dwarfs, but you know, who knows. And we're keeping out, as I mentioned, we're keeping an eye out for strongly lensed supernovae as well.
How many individual exposures do you take?
We take four.
Four?
Yes, one, two, three, four. I think this may be the median combined of those four. And that's the reference over in the upper left. So I'd buy that. So let me recap.
I did skip
the RAID slide. I could go back to it if you want. I just don't know how much I believe this anymore. But
what's the total mass of stars in all your clusters?
The total mass?
Yeah.
So you say a cluster has 10 to the 13th solar masses in stars, more or less, times 50. Because we're looking at 50 clusters.
Five by 10 to the 14th solar masses.
That's right.
So it's 1 in 300 years for 10 to the 11th solar masses.
Right.
Did you get it? 15 per year?
Is that right?
Well, I'm just saying we know what it is per mass pretty well.
Okay.
From Legacy and from the Minucci work, that's okay. Been confirmed by the Kate survey. Everybody agrees for the ellipticals.
Okay.
One for 300 years at 10 to 11 solar masses.
Okay.
So then you can do the math.
I see.
So you've got 60 by 10 to the 13.
Right.
Okay.
Anyways, I wasn't really going to show this slide because it's pretty old. Previous work done by Avishai Galiam measuring the cluster supernova rate has put these sort of limits on it at different redshifts. And how do I explain this? This is really outdated because this is pre-2 progenitor type 1a modeling, but I think what they did to calculate these curves for the delay time of type 1a supernovae is they normalized it to the metallicity seen in galaxy clusters, and they used an exponential delay time, I believe. And if you assume a starburst at redshift 3, you could calculate what you expect the supernova rate to be for different type 1a delay times, more or less. And these are the uncertainties that they got on their measurements. And this is just for a proposal. But ultimately, once we have sort of all our statistical techniques down, and once we infer what fraction of these events are actually in the clusters, we ultimately expect to get an uncertainty roughly about that size. Keep in mind, I did not really want to show this one. So yeah, here, I mean, in a way, the survey hasn't really begun because we haven't had a ton of we've only had that one night of spectroscopy time. But anyways, here's the recap. We had one night of spectroscopy, and hopefully through some shenanigans, we could get a pretty good cluster 1A rate in these clusters. Okay, I guess I could end there. We have yet to apply. We're on trimesters. We have yet to apply for. But yeah, that's the plan. And also, this is just sort of a side note. The Catalina Sky Survey is a near-Earth asteroid search at the U of A that throws out all of their stationary transient events. And we'll be monitoring nearby groups and clusters looking for hosted and hostless events with them in the near future. And in fact, I'm also performing a quick archival search looking for fast optical transients in their archival data. But anyways, I'll just end there. Thanks.
I'll try to get the big picture. You're probably limited by follow-up spectroscopy, is that correct?
Yeah, definitely.
How important for you is it to get 50 clusters? Because if you want to know that, I mean, you have to make a choice at one point.
Mm.
You do either do 50 clusters once a month, or you do 10 clusters more often, 5 times as often.
I mean, sure.
It can be worked out with scheduling and things like that.
Sure.
And since you're limited by the follow-up spectroscopy, I would be tempted to say that you would like to get as much information on your supernovae from your survey.
You mean to get light curves, basically?
Yeah, so to get light curves and things like that. If possible.
Yeah,
you probably thought about this. So
yeah, we thought about it a little bit.
Just for not going that way and say, okay, I do the 50 clusters.
Right, this is partly why we're trying to get two bands now to sort of screen out some of the objects. It just seemed too hard for me to get light curves basically by myself. And maybe
you already have the routine.
But I think it's also a matter of numbers, right? So he wants to find supernovae. Like he finds all the supernovae in 50 clusters, there are 20.
Right. I didn't. I thought it was a.
But the question is, if you find so many transients that you cannot follow them up with, you need the spectroscopy to confirm that it was a supernova, and you're limited by the spectroscopy. I mean, you have to search for the bottleneck.
Yeah,
on your own.
You don't find any at all. It doesn't have to be.
If you get more time on the 90-inch, you can do as many clusters and get light curves and maybe some colors, and then you wouldn't have to rely so much on spectroscopy to sort out your 1A is from your other.
How many colors and what kind of light curves do you need to read out all the possible Italians?
Oh, I don't think you can read out all possible Italians, but I think you can, you know, at some high level of significance, you could probably pick out 1As from the other stuff going on.
Because you basically know what the 1A light curve looks like.
Right. Yeah, and estimate their redshift. Because the colors for 1As are very well defined. So you can probably get redshift and type for most of your 1As, and then everything else, they could be 1As, they could be or type 2s or AGNs or things like that. But,
so just a few, 2 or 3 bands?
I would think
two bands.
Minimum, and then try to get a couple of epochs a month, because then you could see a change in color, and that's very important for winning.
Sounds hard.
It sounds like more telescope time.
Sure.
Nine-inch telescope time, which seems...
It's quite plentiful, but...
Is that the 90-inch spectroscope he's almost described? That's the same 90-inch telescope?
Yes, that's right. Yes.
So you could convince them to use some of the undersubscribed time to put the photometer on instead of the...
Oh, yeah, I think so, sure. Yep.
Just coming concerning your last point. Constraint on Taiwanese drilling time. I guess that your clusters are dominated by elliptical clusters.
Yes, yes. So that's sort of the first order presumption.
The time for, let's say, the tardy Taiwanese supernova.
Sorry, the what type 1A?
Tardy.
Oh, yes, yeah, that's sort of the point, right.
And also, don't forget that probably in your cluster, you have, since you have ellipticals, radular.
Ellipticals what?
Radular.
Oh, okay, yes, sure. Yes.
And this maybe can give you more pieces of on information on the delta time. Because the rate of the Larsa was mentioned before was the average rate of Taiwanese supernovae in elliptical.
Okay, that's interesting. That's something I didn't realize. Okay.
Between Taiwanese produced and radio white.
What is that?
It's on the way.
No, it's not easy to answer. The idea was the one possibility is that these big galaxies are merging small spiral, small galaxies, and this can trigger simultaneously the radio activity and also supply flash and fraction. Inspires the rate of the supernova is larger than the normalized rate.
So the radio loudness, the wave detector, does inspire.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Great.